Hi, my name is Jim Paydar. I'm a retired Chicago Police homicide detective. My son and I wrote a book on beingacop.com, and you can order it on the blog or as an ebook. And I'd like you to listen to ganglandwire.com for some more interesting stories.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. I'm recording in my home studio with a guest co-host, so you may notice that the sound is a little different, and certainly the co-host's voice is different. So all you wiretappers out there, wave and say hi to my good friend, Kansas City Police Sergeant Kate Kozol. Welcome, Kate. How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, Gary. How are you?
Great. Kate did a variety of jobs on the police department. I think her stint as a street narcotics undercover officer was probably the most exciting and certainly the most dangerous, although she did spend some time as a bomb dog handler, and that was probably the most interesting because she was the supervisor over the canine unit and other bomb sniffing dogs. And she was also responsible for training the dogs, and there's a lot of interesting stuff. We may have to do a whole episode on training bomb dogs because that is some interesting stuff. Kate, tell the wiretappers just a little bit about your career.
Well, Gary, yes, I worked in the street narcotics unit, which was quite interesting. You never know how that's going to go until you're out doing it. And being a bomb dog handler was one of the best experiences I've ever had. To watch a dog work and to know how they work is just an incredible experience. And in all mine, there are some times that my bomb dog handler experience as well as my dog is a patrol dog, so they're both dual-purpose dogs, and to have a dog find the bad person and you think that you should be going one way and your dog's telling you to go another way and your dog is more right than you are 9 times out of 10, it's a very humbling experience.
Interesting. So as a patrol dog, that dog had to be able to track people through its sense of smell, and then when he caught him, what did he do?
Well, yes, they track him through their scent of smell, so they track human odor, so they're air scent dogs. So once they get onto that human odor and they lock into it, they have a tendency to turn their head and pull you right to where that suspect is hiding, and then they engage them by biting them.
Well, not so good for the suspect, is it?
No, not so much. Pain compliance usually works.
You know, Kate, I remember one time I was older, and one of my last stints in patrol, and I'm chasing this burglar through some backyards. Of course, he's already way out in front of me and hopping fences, and I'd lost sight of him. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, well, this is just some kid I'm chasing. And all of a sudden, I realize, you know, in my experience, this does not have to necessarily be a 110-pound, 15, 14-year-old kid. This could be a grown man. And here I am all by myself. I don't know where anybody is. That's when you want those patrol dogs to come and to save your butt.
Oh, yes, you certainly do, especially when your dog does have somebody and they're engaged with them and you realize that they're 6'5", 350 pounds, then you're very thankful that you have a dog with you.
Yeah, really. What those dudes do is they outdistance you a little bit, and then they'll stop and wait for you to run by, and that's when you're in a heap of trouble, when you don't know where they are, and they're hiding, and then you run up on them, or you run right by them, and you can be in a heap of trouble. Dog will not run right by them, will he?
No, they sure won't.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to learn a lot more, especially about the training of bomb dogs. I think that's fascinating, and how you do that, how you train dogs to sniff out these different things, and the obfuscation, that's a $25 lawyer word, isn't it? The ways that people try to disguise the smell, say, of narcotics. And I suppose a sophisticated person that planted a bomb could try to wrap a bomb with pepper or some other kind of material that would hide the smell of the explosives in it. Would that be right?
Yes, they do, but you can't disguise the smell of what a dog's trained to. Eventually they'll work to that source and they will alert on it. So
they'll get to it eventually.
Yes, they
interesting,
will.
Interesting. Well, that'd be a whole show for sure. Tonight we're going to talk about the famous Apalachin meeting. I have heard a lot about this meeting over the years. You mob fans out there will know exactly what I mean when I say the Apalachin meeting. Now, first of all, we have to make sure that we're saying it right. I always, and I think a lot of people have always called it with this, the Appalachian meeting in upstate New York of mob bosses from all over the country. Our mob boss, Nick Savella from Kansas City, was caught there. But I noticed our frequent guest, retired FBI agent Bill Owsley, always said Appalachian. And I looked it up, and, you know, that's the way you're supposed to say it. It's not Appalachian, it's Appalachian. So we will call this the Appalachian meeting. This famous meeting has taken on mythical proportions in popular culture. As a matter of fact, there's going to be a movie released on it here pretty soon, sometime in 2019. I will certainly watch for that, and I want to go see it for sure. I'm not sure who's in it right now. I don't think there's any big names in it, but we'll go. Some of you guys out there, Google it and see who's in it. Let me know one of these days. You know, as I said before, our local boss, Nick Savella, was found attending this meeting. There were other Prohibition-era bosses from all over the United States and more modern bosses. We had another boss from Kansas City named Joe Filardo, and he was a Prohibition-era guy. He's one of the Five Iron Men or the Sugar Shack Gang. And I called him that because they cornered the market on sugar back during Prohibition, because sugar is what you needed to make alcohol. You could hardly buy sugar in Kansas City, because these guys were buying every bit of sugar that they could snap up during the early days of Prohibition. The fact that Nick Savella and Joe Filardo were there and caught there really gave our local crime family credibility on a national basis, because we had the bosses of the five families in New York. We had the bosses from Chicago and from, I believe, Santo Traficante from Tampa was there, and Carlos Marcello from New Orleans was there. And this meeting, it was a pivotal turning point in the fight against organized crime, and we'll get into that a little bit. In popular culture, the earliest mention that I could find of this meeting outside of the media was the Peter Moss book, The Valachi Papers. If you remember, Joe Valachi was one of the first people that who came forward and talked about the La Cosa Nostra Mafia and shared a lot of its secrets and named the bosses at the time in the late 50s. He talked about how important that meeting was to all the crime families in the United States. There was a movie with the same title, The Valachi Papers, and Charles Bronson of, what did Charles Bronson play in? He was the death guy who going around. He was a vigilante killer. Remember the name of any of those movies?
I do remember, and no, I don't remember.
I can't
the
remember
name.
Him either. But Charles Bronson played Joe Valachi. The Appalachian meeting was loosely depicted in a 1959 film noir film, or black and white film, called Inside the Mafia. I bet you can find that on YouTube. A lot of those old crime films are on, black and white crime films are on YouTube. It was loosely based on this and based on the Albert Anastasia murder and the subsequent Appalachian meeting. This meeting was comically depicted in the 1999 film Analyze This with Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal. Robert De Niro played a little different kind of a mobster than he has in many of the other mob movies and true crime movies or crime movies he's been in. The narration near the beginning of the 1990 Martin Scorsese film Goodfellas had Henry Hill, or actually it was Ray Liotta, actually it was Ray Liotta playing Henry Hill, saying this: "It was a glorious time before Appalachian, before Crazy Joe Gallo took on a mob boss and started a war." Now in the film, the name Appalachian was actually, as usual, most of us mispronounced it, and he pronounced it Appalachian, but it was Appalachian. No. You might ask, why was this meeting necessary? Why did all these mob bosses from all over the United States want to come and meet face-to-face and be exposed if the FBI or the police stumbled across them? Well, at the time, local police only worked on mob cases on a case-by-case basis. If they had some kind of a murder or they were doing a vice operation gambling game, they then would work on individual mobsters. But they did not really look at it, for the most part, as an organization.
Gary, I have a question.
Yeah.
So back in those times of Prohibition, you mentioned that sugar was the main way that we make alcohol. So did law enforcement, local, or the FBI try to look into who was buying the most sugar or how to get a hold of it? And did they start to track them that way?
Good question. You know, Kate, in Kansas City, in Prohibition, local law enforcement were part of bootlegging operation. They did not look into who was doing what. They more likely were to take payoffs for protecting the bootlegging and the speakeasies, unless they needed to make a what you would call a publicity raid or something. If somebody started complaining about some speakeasy or some club that's getting a little out of hand, they might go in and do that. But mainly they were part of the whole bootlegging operation. The FBI on a national level, they were too busy chasing bank robbers around in the 1920s and 30s. And they really were not, again, it would be after 1957, and we'll get on to that a little later before they really look at the La Cosa Nostra Mafia or the National Crime Syndicate as any kind of an entity that they should go after and really investigate. And so you had a few people like the Treasury agents, Elliot Ness in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I think we had one kind of well-known Treasury agent here in Kansas City, and off the top of my head, I can't remember his name. He didn't make much impact as Elliot Ness did. So he probably looked at that. That's how we probably know the information that they kind of cornered the market on sugar. And maybe he started calling them the Sugar Shack Gang. I don't know. But
yeah, interesting.
It's a good question. But local police were part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Right.
During Prohibition.
Yes.
And not only Kansas City, every major city in the United States. Prohibition was, it's a little bit almost like marijuana is today. It's like, well, it's illegal, but
right,
it doesn't really hurt anybody or hurt anything. And, you know, when in our culture, alcohol is such a huge, huge part of it that it was a failed experiment, I guess, and law enforcement didn't take much part in the experiment. Back to the why was this meeting necessary? These mobsters, especially back east, they knew by the latter part of the 50s, local police, sometimes because they had gotten more professional after the war, after World War II, and all the vets that came out of World War II. I know our police department was, by 1955, 56, was staffed almost entirely with World War II veterans, all the people out of the 30s and during the war that were on were gone. And a little bit different, new breed, not so many people taking payoffs. They weren't 100% squeaky clean.
Right.
A friend of mine came on in 1956. He said the first night he spent riding a district car on West 12th Street, which there was a lot of clubs and strip clubs and clubs on West 12th Street.
There still is a strip club on 12th Street.
Is it really? Mm-hmm. I didn't realize
that. The Shady Lady, but it's not on West 12th.
That's right. It's East 12th, but
yes.
Yeah, there is still a strip club. Wow, the
sure
Shady
is.
Lady harkens all the way back. That's
kind of, yes.
It's kind of the low end of the strip club. I forgot
yes,
about
yes, it
that.
Is.
I worked that in my day when I was young. And
yes.
Pretty tired looking strippers in there.
Oh, yes. I don't think it's changed much since then.
Anyhow, Ray and his seasoned veteran field training officer, although they didn't call them field training officers back then, made the rounds of all the strip clubs, and it was payoff night, as it turns out. And this guy, every club he stopped in, they gave him a little handful of money. And at the end of the evening, Ray said they pulled up in front of police headquarters. They used to change cars out of police headquarters at that point in time. And the man counted out half the money on the seat and kept half of it. And he said, "That's yours." And Ray said, "Oh, no, I don't want any of that. You just take all that." The guy said, "Okay," scooped it up, never said another word to him. And from then on, he rode a car all by himself. They never put him back with a partner the
yeah.
whole time.
Yep.
Now, he went on to become one of the founding members of the intelligence unit, him and a guy named Jimmy Doolin. So everybody wasn't corrupt, but they still was a little bit of corruption back then. But not everybody was, and they were starting to use, and the FBI was using some electronic methods of surveillance, especially back east. This was before there was any law that governed that. So they would just throw on a wire. They just climb the pole and throw on a wire if they were doing a gambling investigation or narcotics investigation, or they'd go in and put some kind of a rudimentary bug in a room. So these guys knew that. And at that time in 1957, they needed to meet But there wasn't Skype for a conference call or FaceTime conference calls or even telephone conference calls. The communication was, telephones were good, but it was limited on how you could get a whole bunch of people in the meeting. So you almost were forced to get together and talk face-to-face if you had people from all over the United States that needed to make decisions. Transportation was improving, and at this time, you could fly from one city to the other pretty easily. You know, certainly it was the interstate system was being developed, so you could easily drive from Kansas City back east, whereas, you know, say in during the war and before the war in the early 50s, before the interstate transportation came in, it would be an arduous, you know, week-long trek on a variety of different blacktop macadam, I think they called them, and even dirt roads. And if you had a bunch of rain or gravel roads, even if you had a bunch of rain, you might get stuck for a while. So you could travel around, and there was a lot more interstate crime because of ease of transportation, and they knew what was going on in other states. Las Vegas was just rising up on the horizon. Bugsy Siegel was out there in L.A., and they were paying attention to what was going on in Las Vegas. A lot of money to be made. There's other Western cities that were growing like crazy. Los Angeles and San Francisco, they grew like crazy. They were sleepy little towns before the war, but after the war. So there's a lot of opportunity out there in those Western cities, and the mob wanted to be part of that opportunity. And they needed to get together to talk about those new territories and who was going to be able to do what. Chicago had already made a big incursion into the film industry during the war and just before the war and right at the end of the war. They had infiltrated unions out there and then used their influence over the unions to extort money from studio chiefs. And they'd actually taken a hit and had, I think, four guys for their bosses at the time. Paul Rica was one of them. A lot of you guys know Paul Rica. And I'm trying to remember who else. Tony Accardo did not get caught up in that one. Oh, Frank Nitti was caught up in that one. He committed suicide before he went in to join on that. But they'd gotten caught up in that. So there was all this new territory opening up, and they needed to talk about what they were going to do. And narcotics was becoming a question. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was the first entity that ever gathered information on the mob in the United States. The FBI didn't. They cared about communists in the 50s, but the Federal Bureau of Narcotics really was working hard on the mob, and they were the ones that were using these off-the-books, shall we say, wiretaps and bugs, and they were writing down things about these organizations, and narcotics organizations, which were mob organizations. They're organizations that were controlled and staffed by people that belonged to the La Cosa Nostra crime family, and which was part of the National Crime Syndicate. There was also a struggle for control back east in New York City between the more Americanized liberal factions of younger people out of World War II and then the old school conservative factions in the mafia, which were kind of holdovers from the old Black Hand days. The progressive and more liberal wing sounds like politics today. The progressive people want to move more into business crime and stay away from all the killings and interfamily wars, while the conservatives want to just keep everything open and, you know, all the power goes to the strongest. And they didn't worry about leaving bodies on the streets. They didn't care about that. They were still used to back in the day when they had all the courts and the police wired up and connected, and then the feds weren't paying any attention. And so this Federal Bureau of Narcotics has started paying attention. So they need to discuss a lot of things like that to make this organization go forward.
So who are some of the people that went there?
And in 1931, we have to go all the way back to 1931 to see kind of who these players were and how they got there. I think there's not a short answer to that question. I think it was 1931, the last old Mustache Pete, Sal Maranzano, was killed by one of the newer guys, one of the progressive faction then, who would then go on to become the conservative faction, Lucky Luciano and his crew. Now, the bosses of all the New York Five families, along with Buffalo, New York boss, Stefano Magadino, and Chicago's Al Capone, had previously met and formalized the geographic boundaries and created kind of a set of rules. Like back in those days, this National Crime Syndicate, for a man to be approved as a made man, all the families had to be given the name, do their own vetting of him, if you will, and then approve of it. they even, the National Crime Syndicate even allowed Jewish members to be part of the National Crime Syndicate. Now, that couldn't be part of the La Cosa Nostra. Now, La Cosa Nostra is, you know, the mafia out of Sicily, and it's all Sicilian. You have to be Sicilian. Now, the National Crime Syndicate was a combination of mafia families or La Cosa Nostra families, but they added in other gangsters. And in Chicago, they added in, they actually, Al Capone was not Sicilian. He was from Naples. He was Neapolitan. And he had other people, Murray Humphreys and other primarily Jewish men. We became part of the outfit. And back east, they had Mayor Lansky as part of the outfit, because they were such, or part of the outfit, part of the National Crime Syndicate, because they were such moneymakers, and they had been through a lot. Mayor Lansky had helped Lucky Luciano kill off that last old mustache Pete and ascend to be, really, he was the boss of bosses back then. Now, in 1936, Lucky was sent to prison, and several of the conservative New York bosses took over, and they, at that point in time, they wanted to return to old world Sicilian traditions, do away with this National Crime Syndicate, and exclude anybody not of Sicilian blood. These crime families met again in 1946 in the now famous Havana Conference, and they also approved of Lucky Luciano remaining as the boss of bosses, and they also agreed that the American Mafia could deal in narcotics. Supposedly, they agreed to have Bugsy Siegel killed for skimming money from the Flamingo in Las Vegas. And during all this time, the Kansas City crime family had always been represented by the Chicago outfit before 1957. After the war, by the 1950s, a younger, more progressive mob guy, a younger, more progressive mobster named Frank Costello rose to the top of the heap. And he wanted to adopt even more progressive and businesslike methods than the old school mafioso ever wanted to approve of. So by 1957, there were several cities that had grown large enough crime families that they felt they deserved a seat on the commission. Philadelphia and Detroit families were wanting a seat at the table. There was a power struggle in New York between some old-school conservative bosses and younger liberal Americanized bosses, and this was creating havoc. Several mob hits in which two bosses were killed, and the New York crime families split even further. The more liberal and progressive faction was Frank Costello and Albert Anastasia. They were opposed by Vito Genovese, Tommy Lucchese, and Carlo Gambino. All of these guys, you recognize their names, came on into the 1960s and 1970s. It's kind of interesting, don't you think, Kate, how they keep getting this older, more conservative faction and the younger, more liberal faction. It keeps coming back up as younger guys come in. It's kind of like, you know, everything in life, even on the police department, we would have younger officers who then wanted to change things. I remember when I came on, they hired 350 guys in a short period of time. And the older guys were, I had one of them tell me, he said, I'm getting off the streets. He said, all you young kids out there, it's too dangerous for me. And I'm thinking, well, screw you, dude.
That is the way it was, and it always is. So you have some of the new millennials that are police officers with their modern technology and don't want to go talk to a suspect for anything. They want to figure it out on a computer or do anything so they don't have to talk to somebody. They're not in foot chases. They're not in car chases. And, you know, it's kind of the same thing. So for each changing generation, that's the same thing. Like, oh, God, I don't want to be out here with these new cops. They don't have any idea how to do police work.
Well, somehow we muddled through. The mafia muddled through in the police departments and the FBI.
So it sounds like they needed to get some organization going and where they were going to go.
Right. That, hence the need for a meeting, a face-to-face sit-down. Because it's a secretive organization anyhow. So it's, you know, you'd have to be ruled by rumor all the time, the mob, because you don't know the truth. People are, you know, they're schooled to not tell the truth or to tell anybody what's really going on, to keep smoke screens out there. A little bit like the government today, I think. I don't know. Better stay away from those politics. A
little bit like the police department, a little smoke and mirrors.
Smoke and mirrors, yeah. In 1957, Vito Genovese thought that the mafia's political climate in New York and on the commission, he thought his politics were right for him to make a power move and become the new boss of bosses. He and Lucchese and Gambino conspired to murder Frank Costello, the more progressive wing, and Albert Anastasia, who was a boss at that time. He was not really the more progressive wing, but he was expanding his power. He wanted to be the boss of bosses. Frank Costello, kind of, they were calling him the prime minister of the underworld, and he kind of had inherited that from Lucky Luciano. But Vito Genovese wanted that for himself. On May the 2nd, 1957, a protege of Vito Genovese, Vincent the Chin Gigante, tried to kill Frank Costello in the lobby of his Manhattan apartment, but he failed. He shot him in the head, and a bullet, I've seen this in real life, the bullet hit his skull and didn't penetrate and went around through the scalp and just left him a big old gaping scalp wound. Have you ever heard of that, Kate?
Yes. So I suppose maybe he was shot with a .22.
You know, I can't. I think it was a .32, but I'm not sure. It wasn't. It
smaller
wasn't like
bullets
a
have a tendency to go in and do damage, but not go through. So yes, I've seen a head injury or two where it's penetrated the skull and then gone around and come out the other side, or got stuck in the skull. Yeah. So, and they were just fine.
Yeah, I was down at Children's Mercy once, and a nurse came out and said, "Officer, you won't believe what I just saw." I said, "What?" She said, "We just got this kid in here, and he was shot directly in the forehead. The bullet went underneath his scalp, but then stayed under the scalp and went around to the back of his head. And we took it out of between his scalp and the bone in the back of his head."
Yes.
He was a lucky kid, wasn't he?
Very lucky kid.
You know, if you guys remember the Ken Ito story that I did here a year or so ago, he was a Japanese bookmaker up in Chicago, and they set him up to kill him, shot him in the back of the head. And these guys in Chicago, they had this thing, rather than having a silencer to keep the sound down, they would load their bullets. They had somebody who would load their bullets with about half a powder round so it would keep the sound down. And they shot him in the head about four times, and none of them penetrated his skull. They took off. They thought he was dead. He crawled into a pharmacy nearby, and the pharmacist thought he was, like, wanting to buy medicine or something, or bandages. He finally wouldn't believe that he was just being shot. He finally stumbled over to a phone booth and called for help himself. It's a hell of a story.
That sounded like a good plan, but failed in implementation.
Yeah, really. Those I would not mess with the bullets. I would want the bullet I knew was going to go in and shoot
and
kill him if I'm involved in that. And those two guys, they both ended up in the trunk of a car, so... So the following month after May, this would be June of 1957, Albert Anastasia's crime family's underboss, a guy named Frank Scalise, called him Don Cheech. I've never heard this name before. He was assassinated June the 17th by Anastasia's nephew, Jimmy Squillante. Now, this seems to be another crazy act by the boss of Murder Incorporated, and that's one thing they were complaining about, was Albert Anastasia was crazy. They also, if I remember right, they were also complaining that he was out selling memberships to the mob for $50,000. He'd get some businessman that had money, and he would say, "You know, hey, dude, $50,000, and I'll make you a made guy in my crime family."
Sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, well, you know what they say about if it's too good to be true.
It is.
It is.
So it sounds to me like with all these killings that's the only way that you could get on somebody's radar. So is that why they needed this, or was it for organizational structure, or how did we get to the meeting?
Well, these killings had happened. These other issues that I mentioned of, you know, geographic boundaries and who had rights to do what in the United States, some new families, Philly and Detroit wanted in. There was a question about whether they should really be involved in narcotics or not, and then it all came to a head with all these killings in New York City. And the most famous one, Albert Anastasia had been trying to muscle in on Havana casino operations of Mayor Lansky in Santo Traficante from South Florida. Vito Genovese said, "We're just going to have to get rid of this Anastasia." Vito Genovese kind of used this as an excuse that we got to get rid of this guy because Anastasia wanted to be the boss of bosses. So on October 25th, 1957, one of the most famous mob killings in the United States, probably, I think it's because of those images, and I remember them, they were all over the newspaper. Some newspaper reporter got in, before they got Anastasia's body out of the barbershop. The barbershop of the Manhattan Park Sheraton Hotel, he's sitting in the barber chair with his head covered with a towel. You know, men used to always you'd get your shave. You'd go to the barbershop to get shaved, and they'd cover your face. That's a classic image, isn't it? Somebody.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Being shot in a barber chair while their face is covered with a towel. I mean, they've used that in I don't know how many movies, even Western movies. I've seen it done in Western movies.
Yes, they have.
Anyhow, he's shot and killed by two masked men. I think one of them was Crazy Joe Gallo, who went on to get killed himself. But this makes Genovese the head of his own crime family and a commission member, and really would make him the most powerful boss in La Cosa Nostra at this time. We had another thing going on in Chicago. Sam Giancana had recently been named to replace Anthony Accardo, or Big Tuna, to be the Chicago outfit boss, and he was on the more liberal side of things. He was more modern. Sam Giancana used the press. He was dating movie star.
Certainly wasn't Marilyn Monroe.
No, but he was all involved in and around her. Anyhow, in 1957, Chicago mafioso Sam Giancana was elected to replace the former outfit boss and member of the commission, Anthony Accardo, which made Sam Giancana a member of the commission now, the National Crime Commission or National Crime Syndicate. And he would be another liberal faction, post-World War II guy that came up through the ranks, and he had garnered a lot of publicity, and he was all involved out in Las Vegas and dated movie stars, and they covered him like he was a movie star back in the day. So one of the main things the New York bosses needed to do was sit down and discuss just how to divide up Anastasia's rackets. He had gambling operations, casinos, and dealing in narcotics. And there were some of the Anastasia capos, like Anello the Lamb Della Croce and Tommy Rava, who were about to go to war against Vito Genovese. They did not want him to take over their crime family and their rackets. They thought they should ascend to, they thought they should be the ones to take over our Anastasia crime family and run those rackets. There was another topic on the agenda. That was the gambling and narcotics activity in Cuba. Cuba was wide open at the time, and Santo Traficante Jr. of Florida, and then there was another northeastern Pennsylvania crime family, Russell Bufalino, Frank DeSimone of Los Angeles, and Carlos Marcello of New Orleans, as well as Mayor Lansky, were all involved with Havana casino operations. You know, what they were doing was paying off the Batista government and skimming money from the casinos. And also, the narcotics trade was being operated from out of the Mideast through Cuba up into the United States. It was a huge heroin trafficking organizations. Kansas City was part of it, and up in New York they were part of it. That was flooding the United States with heroin. I was at the Mob Film Festival, and Terrence O'Malley, who's a local mob historian, pointed out that during the 1940s and 50s, Charlie Parker, the famous saxophonist, became addicted to mafia heroin because it was so plentifully available, and especially in the jazz clubs, because the mob, you know, pretty much owned all the jazz clubs in Kansas City. They kind of make it out to like this black district that, you know, it was all, you know, in what they called the Negro District and 18th and Vine area. But the mob guys, the Italians, they owned the clubs and they employed the musicians, and they also owned all the vice activity in and around those clubs. Except the wheel, except the lottery. They did allow the blacks to keep the lottery on up into the, I believe, up into the 70s, and then it kind of died out anyhow.
The lottery? What's the lottery?
We used to have a thing called the lottery, or the wheel, pulling the wheel. We had a guy down at 18th, about 19th and Vine. Remember, you ever heard of the Blue Front Liquor Store? And
yeah.
Babyface Norris?
Yes.
Well, and before him, God, I can't remember. Felix Payne. Felix Payne was a politician, a black politician who was pretty powerful. He could get out the vote in the black community. He also ran a lottery, which consisted of a wheel that they pulled and would get like three-digit numbers, And then everybody who was a policy seller, you would go in for a dime, you'd make a bet on like 357. And if 357 came up, you'd win like $100 on a dime bet. So it's like a poor people's gambling. We have a lottery today, which, you know, you spend $1 on a ticket and you got a chance of winning $1 million.
Right.
It was the same deal back then. It wasn't, of course, we didn't have the legal lottery. So
right,
it was
right.
Illegal lottery. And it was always focused, the center of it was always down around 18th and Vine, and it moved on down to the liquor store at 19th or 20th and Vine, what's called the Blue Front or Babyface North's place, who took Felix, well, interesting, took Felix Payne's place as kind of the fixer and the conduit between criminals and regular folks and city government and city facilities, city, you know, trash companies. You might help them get a job, or if you had a problem with a city operation, Babyface Norris, and before that, Felix Payne could go talk to somebody and get something done for you. So it was, you know, it's just kind of the way every ethnic area probably developed. The Italians started out like that, and they got their own people who were the fixers with the city, and they were connected with the mob. Well, black folks were the same way. They had their own people who were connected with city politics and city government, and they were also connected to the mob. It just the way it worked.
That's interesting.
So all these issues, the narcotics trade maybe being the most important issue, was on the table at the time because they were making a lot of money out of it, but drawing a lot of heat. Joe Bonanno and Carmine Galante in New York City, and with other American La Cosa Nostra representatives from Detroit and Buffalo and Montreal, had already gone to Palermo, Italy. They had connected up with the Sicilian mafiosa and had a meeting about this, and they solidified this connection, even though a lot of the other mob bosses were saying that we do not deal in narcotics. The Sicilians already had this established smuggling routes and connections from Turkey where they were growing the poppies, and taking the poppies and getting the paste out of it. You know how do they make heroin? How does it come out of the poppy?
That's a very good question.
Shoot.
Well, that's one drug that I don't know a whole lot about, other than you have to have a paste and you get it from the poppy seeds itself. So,
yeah, it seems like they some of you wiretappers out there, you're going to let me know how you make heroin out of the poppy plant, because I'm never too sure. I know they like cut the seed pulp and they end up with a paste out of it and refine it down to heroin. They were doing that in France, in Marseille, France, and it also was a transshipment point from France to Cuba, and then also from France to Canada, and then from there into the United States. You know, and Carmine Galante, or the cigar, he'll become the heroin kingpin in New York City, even while they're claiming that the La Cosa Nostra does not deal in narcotics. He will end up being murdered in a New York restaurant with one of the most dramatic photographs of a mob murder I have ever seen, and you all seen it. He's laying there curled up on the floor of a restaurant underneath his table, and his cigar, and they called him the cigar, his cigar was still clamped in his mouth. So all these issues we've talked about were on the table. Now, you'll have to tune in next time to find out about the man who discovered this meeting and exposed it and forever changed the path of organized crime in Kansas City. You gonna come back with me next time, Kate?
I would love to.
All right, great.
I want to learn more about heroin as well. There's black tar heroin, powdered heroin, brown heroin. It comes in from all over. I do know that some officers wanted to throw it out because they thought it was ripped fuel or some kind of workout stuff. And I'm like, no, I think you have some heroin there. Hmm. It was quite a significant amount.
How was it packaged?
They packaged it at the time in capsules. So you would take the old capsules and you would dump them out and fill it with that, and then some of them were also in your typical clear plastic baggie as well.
So like narcotics dealers in Kansas City primarily they were dealing crack, it seemed like, in the inner city anyhow, and it's mainly where most of the narcotics activity is that we ever exposed.
Yeah, some of them, that's all they had ever seen. A lot of times field training officers would bring their recruits by some of my stops because they hadn't seen heroin, meth, crystal meth, cocaine, crack, what the different kinds of it looked like. Back in the day, the crack used to be made with the red sulfur. Well, nowadays they're not, and so now it looks beige. Well, originally when it came out and it was so much easier to get a hold of the red sulfur, it had like a pink hue or a red hue to it. Nowadays you can't get a hold of it that much and it looks like it's yellow.
Interesting. So and the heroin trade, see, I think back to my days in the earlier 70s, we had the Blue Capsule Gang, which was out of the projects around 12th and Paseo over there, and they were the main, the narcotic kingpins of Kansas City, and they ended up taking them all down. But that, they called them Blue Capsule Gang because they bought blue capsules and loaded the heroin in that. So I thought heroin always came in capsules. But then later on, kind of left working any kind of narcotics, and I came back, and that's when that's when crack cocaine hit big time. And that was always in little baggies, and it was little rocks.
Yes. Yes.
So we went through that, and that took over everything, it seemed to me like. It seemed like nobody cared about heroin or wanted heroin in 1980.
It did seem to go by the wayside, but also in the 80s it was more heroin chic, and there was a lot of people doing heroin that was more underground or more white male or more in the gay population. Heroin was always a big deal, and most officers think of heroin as black tar heroin, so unless they see a spoon and a syringe, they don't associate what looks like ripped fuel or any kind of workout supplement as being heroin,
which is a brown powder, correct?
Yes, some of it's brown and some of it can also look more white as well.
So then coming on into the more modern times, let's bring us on up the more modern times in heroin. Now people have been using this OxyContin and oxycodone and started with Demerol, and it's these synthetic heroines, or synthetic opioid-type narcotic. And I understand now that it's easier and cheaper to get heroin.
Yes.
And so what's the distribution like today? Is it all across the board, or in the inner city, and black folks still primarily using crack and white people using heroin? That was my memory of that.
Some of those things haven't changed as much. However, there's more methamphetamine in the black population. There's more heroin spread across the black population, the white population, out in suburbia. With all the kids and the teens, heroin is bigger in some of our richer white high schools than it's ever been in any place else. So it's transcending all of its normal social stereotypes.
It seems like in the modern times, it's not so important to shoot it. And that's what my memory of is. If you had heroin, you had to have a needle and a spoon and water and heat it up a little bit and then inject it. But it seemed like they don't always shoot it.
You can smoke it. You can snort it.
With the same effect. Or you don't know. You've never felt the effect.
I've never done heroin. I could go do some research and get back to you, Gary, but I don't think that's a good idea.
You don't need to sacrifice yourself. You know what we used to say when the old vice officers, they'd go over the hill. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Well, you to go take heroin, it would be like going over the hill. Vice officers that work prostitution, well, if they went ahead and did the deed and then arrested the girl, then they said they went over the hill.
Oh.
And that happened back in the day.
Yeah, you had a lot of times when you tried to buy drugs, if you wouldn't do them with somebody, I mean, you had to be quick on your feet. Like, I have to go home to my boyfriend if he knows that I've smoked this, then, you know, and on and on. And then you had all your little props that you set up so they'd believe that, you know, you did it. But if you weren't smoking it or shooting it with them, sometimes they weren't as inclined to believe you. So...
All right. Well, cool. All right, folks, we're going to get out of here now and let you get on with your business, and be sure and tune in next week. The second episode of the Apalachin meeting and the man who exposed this meeting and how it forever changed the path of organized crime in the United States. And don't forget, I have my movie, Gangland Wire. You can rent it for $1.99 streaming on Amazon. You can buy your own DVD copy of it for, I can't remember how much now. Well, on my website, it's $14.95. If you buy the hard copy DVD, and I know a lot of you don't have DVD players anymore, but if you get the DVD, it's got several special features on there that you're not going to get in the streaming form. I have my book, Leaving Las Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. Don't forget, if you want to take a mob tour of Kansas City, even you guys in Chicago or Detroit or wherever you're, even Sweden or England, we got a lot of listeners, David Breakspear over there in England, Dean from Ireland, we got a lot of people all over the world, Jacob Appert from Sweden, we got people. Download my Kansas City Mob Tour app, and you can see pictures of a lot of the places that I've talked about in past episodes, and a little bit of text and a map that shows where they are in the city. Pictures of what they used to look like, pictures of what they're like, what the location is like now. Go to, if you're on iTunes, give us a review. If you're on another podcasting app, I don't know if they do reviews. I'm not sure. I've not looked at all of them. I'm not the best businessman in the world. We just like to entertain here. All right, Kate, say goodnight.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night, folks.